The following program about the Chetco Bar fire was recorded in the field on Saturday, September 2nd, 2017. For up-to-date information on the Chetco Bar fire, please call 541-469-1177.
Hunter, KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio, and Community Conversations. I've been on hiatus for a while, but we've been really trying to get this interview set up today. We are a community facing adversity, as you know, because of the Chetco Bar fire. Incident Command Public Information Officer Terry Krasko, who is going to better at talking about himself than I would ever be. Terry, thanks for being here today. How are things?
I'm fine. Thank you very much, and I appreciate you asking me to speak today. I work for the U.S. Forest Service in Arkansas, and we have 43 states working on this fire incident from as far away as Alaska to Maine, and I work on the Ozark-St. Francis National Forest. My day job, I work as a staff officer, and I have recreation and archaeology and GIS and tribal relations and a little bit of environmental planning and do some litigation work, too. But I do this as a collateral duty. I've been a public information officer for 31 years now. It's 31 years.
31 years, so that makes you right around my age, I'm guessing. I have to do the age thing. You know what? You answered one of my questions right off the get-go. How many firefighters and from where? You said from all the different places that they're from, but how many boots are actually on the ground fighting the fires?
You know, that number varies almost daily. We don't keep people here forever. They usually work roughly 2 to 3 weeks on a fire. Then we send them home to get some rest and relaxation, R&R, and they've already asked me to extend, so I will be here 3 weeks here in Oregon, and they'll let me go home for at least 2 days. I'm hoping that I get to see my wife for a little bit longer than that. I think this year I've been out roughly 60 days on fires across the country, so I've been in Wyoming, I've been in South Dakota, I've been in Grand Junction, Colorado, Florida, and Oregon happens to be my last assignment.
Wow. You're traveling with the fires. I guess it's fire season. You go where the fires are. Thank you for doing that. What a commitment you must have. And I know that can be stressful on a family. So because we do a lot of work with veterans in our community, when I hear about the kind of service you're giving, as far as I'm concerned, that's another kind of military service, sir. And thank you for that. And your family sacrifices going unnoticed, too, for all the firefighters and all the different people who are here. We talked a little bit about the Oregon National Guard and where they're located, because that's very interesting to us. We know how the National Guard works, some of us, and some of us don't. Can you kind of give us a broad-based explanation of the importance of the National Guard in general and what they're actually doing to fight the fire here in Curry County?
Okay, so when I first arrived here, I was aware that the National Guard was providing security at checkpoints, and also they had two helicopters, large helicopters, that were providing water drop support onto the fire and any kind of they were available for emergency evacuation. And then here, just in the last several days, another pretty large group of National Guard has showed up. They have put 6 crews on the line, and they are stationing these lines that we've been working on for the last 10 days or so, and they're right up against the town of Brookings. They're providing that safety and security of holding those lines, putting out the hot spots, keeping it in check, continuing to cool that line and provide that small margin that we've already built and keep it right here so that our friends and families here in this part of Oregon stay safe. That's what it's about. I know that this group has come out of various parts of Oregon, but I think a lot of them are out of Portland. So they come down here, they make at least a 2-week commitment, and there may be more after that, but we know that they've had a presence here for quite some time, and we're very, very thankful for the the National Guard, the state's commitment towards this fire as well.
So how many members are in each crew, and then kind of do the math for me?
Sure thing. Well, typically a fire crew is made up of 20. So they are made up of crews of 20, and there are six of them right now. And I'm waiting to see. I think we may get more here in the future, but and they may rotate around the other side of that, their tour. So they are here with these crews for a minimum of 2 weeks, and they'll be right alongside of everybody else. They're part of the mix. They have had wildland fire training. They're very well physically fit. They're endurance people. That's the kind of people that we need fighting fires, and we're very pleased that they're here.
So what goes into building that fire line? We hear that term kind of tossed around, and we know there's bulldozers involved, but we don't know everything that happens on a fire line. Can you kind of give us an idea what that work was like from day one until it's actually a line that can help and not allowing the fire to advance?
So what we do is the idea behind building a fire line is to deprive the fire of fuel. So a fire line is scratched down to bare mineral soil, and it can vary in width. So sometimes we use an existing road as a fire line, but if that road is brushed in heavily, we may have to brush along that road, put crews, hand crews, go in there and brush it out, take out some of the big vegetation and strengthen that. Also, we do use bulldozers to go in where there is no road, and if the topography is allowing that kind of a machine to get in, they can scratch a line that's as wide as their blade. And then the other lines are what we call hand lines, and a typical 20-person crew, and that includes not just men but women out there too. They do this work too, and they will go out with hand tools. And what it does is people take a lick and they move down. They take a lick and they move down, and then the next person takes a lick. So when you have 20 person that pass through and they're building fire line, they can actually build quite a bit of line, but not everybody has to build the whole line themselves. They have different tools, and the last person is kind of the cleanup, and they just keep moving down. They call it bumping down, keep moving down.
So you used a term, brush out, and I kind of have an idea what that means, but is that sometimes burning?
Okay.
Maybe give me a few more details.
Okay, so after we've built a line that has gone down to mineral soil, then we wait for the moment that is proper, and sometimes it's almost immediately. But sometimes it's a waiting game when we're looking for the wind to be correct. We're waiting for the onset of the fire coming closer to us to make our decision when we will actually take other tools called drip torches, fusees. Some of them we have mounted on ATVs we pull behind a trailer, and we will start actually setting fire along that line. We fight fire with fire. And then what that does is it consumes the fuels that are coming from that flaming front towards that fire, and we make a black line at that point. We want it to be wide. And then the next trip around on this is then after we've set it on fire, then we have to start cooling it down. So there's a long process, and as I was mentioning with the National Guard, and all the firefighters are part of this, we have to go into the next thing, which is called mop-up. So everything got hot. Now we got to cool it down to the point where some point in time we can walk away and not have to worry about it anymore.
So when you say not worry about, what you mean is that fire is not going to jump from point A to point B into Brookings.
Yes. And I will tell you this. I mean, we have made a very wide line here. But we want to make sure that we've got it wide enough so that if wind does pick up, it's wide enough that it doesn't just blow something right over the top of us. I will tell you that I have worked with crews. We built fire lines that are quarter mile wide. 30, 40 mile an hour wind comes and blows things right over the top of us. That can happen. But the other part of what happens out there, too, is that we have people that are also in the green part of the line where it hasn't burned, and they're looking in there, too, to make sure that no sparks have gone over that line. It's labor-intensive. And it takes a lot of effort. Sometimes it's boring work, but you're marching through this real estate looking for things that are hot, even where they shouldn't be. That's what you want to make sure. And if there is something there, you get on it immediately.
You know, you talked about wind shifts and things like that. I was in Arizona, and I did a fundraiser for a fallen firefighter and a fallen police officer, had a freak accident and had my foot crushed, and I had to leave and come back from Arizona to Oregon, and it happened to be the day, and it was a miserable hot day, and we had to come through Congress, Arizona, which is not that far from Prescott. It's not that far from where those 19 firefighters lost their lives. Their spotter lived, but out of that crew of 20, 19 firefighters were lost. So we know it's a dangerous job. We know that people put their lives on the line every day, and I hope that our community is conveying how much we appreciate that and how much we understand what they're doing for us by the signs and things like that. But is there anything else that our community can do for our firefighters?
You know, I always hear this first, and there's a lot of people that are very concerned about the firefighters on these large fire operations. I want to tell you first that we're living in tents, we're getting fed, our basic necessities are being taken care of. What I always try to point to is that in this community, after we leave, you have a volunteer fire department here. And those folks, they work for free 24/7. They're in your community all the time. And I was always asked that you think about them first. And also would like for folks to think about the people who are evacuated. And if they're in a Red Cross center or I understand there's a tribal place down in California that they're taking care of people. Think about them too. They're displaced from their homes. That's a very big hardship for them. So we appreciate all the love that we get from folks. And I see cookies all the time. People come in, they come in next door to us and they're bringing stuff all the time. So sweet. Wonderful, wonderful people here in this community. But I want to make sure that people understand that we are being taken care of. Now, if you still want to do something beyond that, there is a Wildland Firefighters Foundation. And I can get that information for you later. And they take donations from all over the country. And this foundation does provide support. So this Wildland Firefighters Foundation supports the families of lost firefighters, and I'm sure that the folks from that Grand Mountain Hotshot crew are in there, not only in their prayers, but they also have some support from that foundation. So if people have the desire, we can get that address, and they're always taking donations for that because it's a very large effort out there amongst the firefighting community.
Now, I have a couple more questions. Every day, there's a briefing at about 6 a.m. That happens daily, right?
Not only at 6 a.m., but at 6 p.m., because we got people working at night.
Okay.
I attend both of them every day.
So a typical briefing includes what? And, you know, who typically are in those briefing meetings? And, you know, what agencies, nonprofits are represented in that briefing, in those briefing meetings?
Okay, so we go through a wide range. Probably one of the very first people that shows up on that little stage there in front of that great big map is, if we're having the briefing at 6 a.m., is the night operations chief. And that person has been listening to all the division supervisors a half hour earlier, and I go to that meeting too. And they're reporting out what happened overnight. So they know what's happened, and they know what to set up for the next day, this coming day. So they have that discussion of what happened. And then there'll be another operations person that will say, okay, and this is what our assignments will be for the day. And they will set out what their big objectives are. We'll have also the incident meteorologist will speak, and we get the very specialized weather that comes for this incident. And, of course, they have the disposal of the entire National Weather Service to bring us information, but sometimes they actually do some radio sounds. They'll put balloons up, and they will look at what's going on here. They make their predictive models based on what they've seen, and we have remote weather stations up on the mountain right now. And also, some of the crews have belt weather kits, and they will take the little weather report themselves, and they radio it in. And what that does is it feeds the incident meteorologist, or the IMET, they like to call him the IMET. He will take a look at those and see if it's verifying and validating what he had predicted. After this weatherman gives his report, then we have a fire behavior analysis. And based on the weather, the topography, and the fuels, they make a prediction on how fast that fire they think will run today, flame lengths. They'll give us spotting distances, probability of ignition, technical terms like energy release components, a lot of different kind of jargons in it that we'd use as firefighters. But it's so that we have a healthy expectation how that fire is going to behave and how we act accordingly so that we don't get ourselves in a bad situation. After that, we have people that will talk about logistics, the comfort needs that we have in the camp. There'll be somebody that will talk about radio. Oh, we've added a new repeater up there, so now you got to add this frequency into your radio. And of all things, at the one of the very things that we talk, we even have a human resources specialist who talks about mutual respect and dignity for everybody in the camp. So it's a wide-ranging group of people, and probably the last person that we hear from is the incident commander, and this has a unified command, so we will have the commander that's of this Type 3 incident. It's actually a Type 1 team, but it's a Pacific Northwest 3. And they're based here in Oregon and Washington. And then we have the Oregon State Fire Marshals involved with us, Oregon Department of Forestry, and we also have the Coos Fire Protection Association is with us here too. So we got a lot of players that work together. And this incident command system, of all the things that we do in the government, this really works well, and we work well together.
Why is that?
Well, we have a common goal, put the fire out, and we don't worry about turf battles. It's all about working together and getting the job done. So even on this Pacific Northwest team, it's made up of people that are not only from federal agencies, but from state, from counties, some municipalities, and we have a wide range of people, different talents. And usually what happens when they get together as a team, they drop their uniform that they wear every day at work, and they'll put on a shirt kind of similar to what I've got on. I'm actually part of a Type 1 team in the southern United States, and this is what we wear, and we forget about who works for what because we work towards a common goal.
So mission and task oriented, a lot like the military sounds like, and a lot of protocol involved in that, in decision making. I want to go back to what you talked about, a predictive model with regards to the weather. We have some unusual issues here because of the Chetco effect, and people hear the term Chetco effect a lot, and they see it as something that allows us to have more sun and less fog and less rainy days than north and south of us. But what part does a Chetco effect play into, number one, how that fire is burning? Number two, the predictive model must have to factor that in. And number three, what's going on right now with the Chetco effect?
Okay, so we have had several predictions of the Chetco effect. And this, a more technical term for it is a phoehn wind, F-O-E-H-N. And what it does, it's a gravity wind, and it is also directionally challenged. It actually turns the clock around a different direction that you normally get, because when you're getting ocean breezes, that's when you get the fog that moves in. But the Chetco effect is actually pushing the other way towards the ocean. It would be northeast to southwest. And so that really has been a big concern for us, because that is where Brookings is. And if we have high winds, that again tests our lines that we've constructed. So we've had twice some big warnings on Chetco effect. They've been overpredicted and underperformed. So actually that made us very happy. And we were looking at possibilities of getting 30 to 40 mile an hour winds and end up being 10 to 15, which were reasonable for us.
We like to think that some prayer warriors had something to do with that, you know, and so I'm joking in a way, but dead serious in another. So what I'm looking for is those things that you can say as the public information officer to let our community know that were doing pretty darn well in spite of the circumstances and give us a feeling of security and safety?
Well, you know, a lot of people have asked me, particularly in the media, Terry, what's your worst case scenario? And I told one of them, I don't have one. And then I've thought about this a number of times, and I said, I think that those firefighters out there are doing the very best, and they are going to hold that line. They're going to do the absolute best they can. And so far, we have been very, very successful. So the home team is winning so far. I know that we have had 6 losses here of homes. That is absolutely terrible for those people who have lost homes. And my thoughts and prayers for those people. And I've been at places where I've seen 67 homes burn, and I've been to places where I've seen 167 homes burn, and I've been to places last year in California where I saw 600 homes burn. And in Texas, I saw 4,500 homes burned. Losing one is terrible. It's terrible. But I want to say one last thing is, if we have evacuation levels and they ask you to leave, it's worse. It's terrible to lose your home, but it's a terrible tragedy to lose your life because other people know and love you and they want to see you again. So you're important.
You know, and I outlined this interview, and so this falls right in line with the next topic. Advice for local citizens. What 3 things would you tell citizens they should do to be safer?
Well, you know, the sheriff made a really good comment at the public meeting about a week or so back. And even though the town of Brookings is on a level 1 evacuation, that's this readiness. So he kind of said, we really should always be in a readiness level, whether it's a fire. I have grandkids in Houston right now, went through this hurricane. So you want to have this readiness level in your head at all times. And if something were to happen, what would you want to take with you? And you should kind of think it through because with there are certain things you can't be without. If you had to just leave in your car, you got to have your wallet or your purse, your medication that you take every day, your glasses, your children, of course, pack some food, maybe a sleeping bag, your pets, pet food, all those things that you would need to sustain for a while to be away from your home. So that readiness is to think about it, but the next level is the set. Ready, set. That's the level 2 that we've been talking about. And that is where now you've known what things you wanted to take. They should be in the trunk of your car, the back of your pickup truck, in your RV, whatever you got that's going to be able to move off your home. And then the go part is you just get in because you've already thought about it and you want to be safe. And then you put your hands, put all the things in the hands of the firefighters that are out there, and they're going to do the very best they can to keep that home safe.
Real quick, what is the best way to stay informed for your average citizen? Now, we have the newspaper, which does a great job, and we have some social media sources, which, you know, a lot of the information ends up from the briefings on those social media sites. But can you give us a good email address or a place to inquire via computer? And then we'll talk about the phone number that people can call for information.
Okay. So what you need to do is to log into the Curry County Sheriff's website. There is going to be a thing called a Curry Alert, and it's based on telephone technology. And when you give them your landline telephone, it knows where you are. And if there is something that's happening at your location, they can reverse dial back to you with a message saying, this is happening right here with you right now, and you can get that message. But listen to the radio. If they're putting out an alert on the radio, listen to that. Of course, the internet is only as good as if you've got power, of course. If you get a cell phone, that works pretty good too. You just need to dial in on all parts of things. I will say as a last resort, though, and this is probably one of the last places you want to get the information, is if something really is to be happening immediately in your neighborhood, you're going to see somebody knocking at your door, and it probably will be a State Highways Patrol, or it might be the sheriff, it might be a firefighter, and they're making one last sweep of the neighborhood to make sure that you've left your home. That's probably the last place you want to hear it, but I know there's people that don't have television. They don't. Some of them don't have radio or phone at all, so you got to kind of help yourself, too, to pay attention to what's going around you.
Well, there's a reason that people move to Curry County. Some of us want to be off the grid sometimes, and computers and things like that sometimes just get in the way of enjoying the beach. But in this case, we have to leverage technology and our better interests. And a phone number that you can call is 541-469-1177, and there's actually a phone bank. And I was talking to Terry a little bit before the interview, and he said they field about 1,500 calls a day. Tell me about that.
That was one of the highest days we've had when the sheriff announced about 9:30 a couple nights ago that they had changed from level one to level two in some parts of this area. We had a lot of calls, and we stayed up to way past midnight answering the phones. So it was, there was eight people answering phones. And as soon as you'd hang up, it'd ring again. And so one of the things is that people need to hear that there's a calm voice at the other end of the line, that they know what's occurring, can give you good sound advice, and to make good decisions from that point, whatever it is. And in this particular case, it was a level two alert, which means they did not have to leave their home, but it was beyond just the awareness level. Now it is pack your stuff and make sure that you have it. So in that particular situation, we did take lots of calls from people and very concerned. But we get people from over and over every day that call. They want to know.
So I have a real quick question. This is a hardball question, you know. And I always say, if you don't know the whole story, if you don't know the backstory, you don't know the whole story. But today I want to focus on the future, because I think the best way to predict the future is to create it. So I'm asking you a question that maybe kind of give us general ideas behind it. What should be on our local leaders' to-do list in the short term and the long term to deal with emergencies better than we've been able to do it this time? And I'm not saying we did a bad job, because everybody rolled up their sleeves and I believe did the best we could locally. But what would you tell our leaders would be a good path in the short term and going forward in the long term?
Okay, there is a wonderful website, if you have internet, called FireWise. If you just Google FireWise, what it teaches people who have homes, mobile home, or just simply property, how to build defensible space for your home. Now, you probably heard that when the firefighters came in, they had people evaluating homes. Sometimes they use that word triage. I don't like that term, but they were evaluating homes here, and they did way over 1,000 homes. And then what they did next was what they called prep the homes. So what they did is they built that defensible space that really, as a homeowner, you should be thinking about. And that gives you that space so that if a flame front did come to your property, you'd be able to survive it. Your home would be able to survive. And so there's easy things to do. Clean the brush, clean your gutters, move the wood pile. Go to FireWise and look at that and work with your local fire department on that too.
You know what? You've been a fantastic and easy guest. I love the fact that you come here with those new nerves of steel and sit here and tell us a straight scoop. And what people cannot see is the sincerity in your eyes, sir. And I just want you to know that I took note of that, and I feel better. I feel safer, and I feel blessed to have you and the entire team and our firefighters here working in our behalf. And God bless us all. Look after y'all. And if you need anything, let me know. And come on back and talk to us again, I hope.
It's my honor to be here. Really, it is.